Good morning or good afternoon, everybody. Thank you very much for the invitation to speak today. My name is Marie Gallagher, and I am of council with Covington and Brelling in our Dublin office. Just a little bit maybe on that very quickly to follow up on what Ken has been saying. I'm a food and drug lawyer. I've been a food and drug lawyer since I was in Brussels over 20 years ago. And in fact, I worked both in Brussels, I came back and worked with Arthur Cox, I then set up my own practice. So this has always been an area in which I have practiced. And for the best part, actually in 1998 was the first time I came across Covington and Burling when one of their senior partners came to Dublin looking for a lawyer here to advise a client of theirs on launching a product. And it was a nutritional product, and they came in. I remember getting a call in Arthur Cox as a baby lawyer, and they said, we'd like to meet you, and we'd like to talk to you about your approach and about how you might do this and whether you can actually help our client. And I thought, this is fantastic, but like, I better get somebody grown up to come with me. So I went into one of the partners and I said, listen, will you come to this meeting with me? These guys are coming over from London. And he said, sure, I haven't a clue. I don't know. And I said, you don't have to know. You just have to sit there and look kind of somber and serious and not. And as it happened, they called me. They then went off to meet a couple of other law firms in town, and I got a call from the airport to say, yes, listen, we would like to instruct you and instruct your firm, and we would like you to help us with this. And that was the beginning of my relationship with Covington and Burling. And ever since then, right through my career in Arthur Cox and my own practice working for myself, I have effectively been their person on the ground. And we talked many times over the years about whether I would join the firm, whether they would set up an office here, whether they wouldn't. We have the largest global practice in food and drug regulatory law in the world. We have the biggest law firm in Washington, D.C. So a lot of our clients, particularly in the pharmaceutical side and the technology side, are based here in Ireland. So already we were advising them. So we eventually decided a number of years ago that that this was the way to go. And again, as Ken said, some of that was, as my colleagues in London say, a Brexit defensive move for our competition and regulatory lawyers. But we very much looked at it as, let's set up a law firm here, let's set up a partnership here, and let's do this properly. And I'm very grateful for that, because as Ken says, it has given me a role which is very exciting, working on very exciting matters with fantastic global lawyers. And so from my perspective, long may it continue. What I'm going to talk to you about over the next few minutes, however, is a little bit more agricultural. It is, you know, we've heard a lot this morning about law reform, about the common law, about how Brexit is potentially going to change how we practice law, and the influences of common law and European law and civil law and all of those interesting and very important issues. What I'm going to try and do is give you a flavour as to, you know, what is happening on the ground with some of the clients that we advise in the food and drug sector. So just to give you a little bit of the clicker. Just to give you a little bit of information and a few statistics around the whole area of agri-food, for example, because, of course, agri-food is such a huge issue in Ireland. It is our largest indigenous economy, and you will all be very familiar with the threats that Brexit poses to our agri-food industry. We export 90% of what we produce in this country. We are a net food exporter. Within that, the latest figures from Board BIA are that 13.6 billion food and drink exports in 2017. The industry employs 173,000 people, or thereabouts. And of those exports, 38% of them go directly to the UK. 50% of all the beef we produce goes to the UK, and 22% of our dairy. We are, in terms of dairy, we are the biggest global manufacturer of cheddar cheese, and we said the only market we have for that cheddar cheese is the UK, because they have similar tastes to us and they buy our cheddar cheese. They don't make it, well, they make a bit of it, but they don't make it in the same quantities as we do. So we supply them with their cheddar cheese. And so the trade and the history of trade between Ireland and the UK is hugely significant. The other thing to note is that the UK is not self-sufficient in food. They can't actually feed themselves after about September of every year. So they are about 60% sufficient in food. So after that, they have got to rely on imported food. And the tradition and the background and the history of trade between our two islands is that we have been very happy to supply them with that food. And we hope to be able to continue to do that into the future. In another forum, I chair the Agri-Food Committee at the British-Irish Chamber of Commerce. And that is very interesting, and certainly has been very interesting since Brexit. Wasn't all that interesting before that, but it has suddenly become very interesting because we represent food companies in the UK and also here in Ireland. And so to see what is really happening and the real challenges that they are facing on the ground is really quite interesting and quite eye-opening. But what I can tell you is that there is a huge determination and commitment for trade between the two islands to continue. And I think that is something that everybody involved, certainly at a practical trade and business level, are interested in doing. So what I'm going to do quickly, we're going to just look at the state of play, which as we all know, has probably changed about 10 times since I stood up here in front of you. I was telling Ray earlier, I was at a committee thing yesterday presenting for the British Irish Agri-Food, and literally we was told to turn off all of our phones, and then 2 seconds later the chair said, breaking news. And you know, it's kind of like, okay, well that puts my presentation out the window. So it kind of puts some of this out of the window as well. But as Ken says, this is about, you know, this is where we are now. Where we are when we come out of here might be in a very different situation. We're going to look at the state of play, where we are or where we think we might be, possible outcomes, key issues. I want to just flag for you, I'm not going to get into the detail, but just flag for you some of the issues around drug regulation, some of the things that are concerning a lot of the pharma companies and regulatory lawyers who advise them. Similarly on the food side. And then, you know, the UK, if all of this works out and if everything kind of goes very smoothly over the next 48 hours and over the next couple of months, then hopefully we are looking at a transition period, which gives people a lot more time to prepare. You know, there's still going to be a huge amount of work to do, but there's going to be a little bit more time in which to do it. If things do not work out over the next number of hours and days and weeks, we are then looking at a no-deal scenario. And so I want to just touch on that because a lot of preparatory work has now been done, both on the UK side and the EU side, in terms of how are things going to continue in the food and drug sector if there is a disorderly Brexit. So I keep flicking this on and forgetting that it's not flicking in front of me. My apologies. So the state of play. You know, really, we can probably skip all of this because you go down, you look at every single stage right from December 2017 when we decided on the phase one. And this was actually key insofar as identifying the issues around budget, citizens and Ireland. So these were the three things. We're, you know, 11 months later, we're still there and hopefully some progress has been made. But you will see that there have been various things that have happened along the way. The Chequers meeting in July the UK white paper on the future relationship. And so there's a lot of politicking and negotiation going on. And it is giving us all plenty of headaches and things to do. But insofar as where we are now, so a month ago, by the way, the second bit of that slide didn't exist kind of last night. But, you know, the As of less than a month ago, we were told the negotiations were completely deadlocked. This idea of an extension, which was made by the UK, the Commission floored it in order to kind of help out Prime Minister May. The backstop was not solved. In fact, there was no progress made on it. And really, the talk from Brussels was very much that the ball was in the British camp, and it is entirely in their camp. It's like, come back and make a proposal. As of about 3:30 or 3:40 yesterday, when Tony Connolly got the scoop, we heard that there was a text. Now, prior to that, yesterday, the European Commission, I don't know, was it a leak or what it was, but prior to that actually happening, the Commission had published their own no-deal contingencies. And those contingencies have covered a whole range of different areas and setting out how the EU, you know, plans to deal with certain issues, air transport being one of them, in a no-deal scenario. Then a number of hours later, we get this, that there is an agreed form of wording, agreed between the negotiators, not agreed by anybody else, but agreed between the negotiators. And then this new word, this new thing, Brexit is just the gift that keeps giving, the swimming pool. So it's like, what is the swimming pool? So the swimming pool, apparently, for those of you who missed it on the news, is that, you know, it's like one big swimming pool, and Northern Ireland is going to be the deep end in terms of, you know, the customs union will be the whole pool, one assumes, and then the kind of the regulatory alignment, the various different rules that will keep Northern Ireland closer to Europe will be the deep end. So I suspect that's something we'll hear quite a bit about over the next days, certainly. You know, the word in Brussels and in London and here in Dublin is that the next 48 hours really are very critical in this scenario. And if the Prime Minister survives the next 48 hours and indeed into next week, that that, you know, there may be real progress, but that it is a very critical time. So, possible outcomes. What might possibly happen? And, you know, and again, we're looking, you know, and it's like, you know, we could have a soft Brexit, we could have a hard Brexit, who knows what kind of Brexit we're going to have. However, I think what is clear is that Brexit is going to give us a legal and regulatory border of some description. So whether it's soft, whether it is hard, there are going to be changes, ultimately. And, you know, if you look at the soft Brexit from a regulatory perspective, what will happen if there is a transition period is that EU law will continue to apply as if the UK were a member state. And then come the 1st of January 2021, we'll be looking at potentially an EEA-type arrangement where there will be an extension or a type of a duplication of the internal market. That is, you know, the best-case scenario in terms of a soft Brexit around regulatory issues. And, of course, that is what our clients want. They want as close to the status quo as possible. And, interestingly, that includes businesses in the UK. So whatever they may feel politically about, you see they're trying to sabotage me now, they actually feel very much in terms of doing business that they want to have the status quo and they want to have the kind of keep things as they are. From a trade perspective, in the transition period, it'll be effectively the customs union and a soft Brexit. And then in the future relationship, perhaps no customs union, but a deep facilitation between the UK and the EU. A hard Brexit, on the other hand, will mean that there will be limited unilateral recognition on each side. And agreed and sector agreements and potentially mutual recognition agreements and in the future relationship. From a trade perspective, so looking at customs and trade and tariffs, you'll be looking at WTO rules and perhaps an emergency free trade agreement. So a CETA type then into the future relationship. You know, the other question that was had been raised prior to yesterday was this issue of Article 50. Is there any chance that it could be extended? I think the general view is that that is highly, highly unlikely, because it's going to be very, very difficult to get all 27 to agree to that. And of course, under Article 50, it needs to be unanimous. That said, again, who knows what will happen over the next few weeks. If we get to a critical point where everybody feels that another few weeks might actually help, that might be something that might be on the table. But I think that that is probably an unlikely scenario at this point. So from a drug perspective, looking at the whole area of the regulatory framework around drugs, what are the issues that are causing concern? And I've just flagged a few of them there just to give you a sense. So this is in a Brexit situation. Again, it really doesn't matter whether we have hard or soft, because these issues are still going to be relevant. So the fact that there won't be UK participation in EU regulatory processes or networks, that is going to be a serious loss. A serious loss from the perspective of all of the things we heard about this morning around common law and the influence and all of that. But it's also going to be a huge loss because they're bigger than us and they have more people. And, you know, certainly in an Irish context, so it's not always about simply the common law and the legal system. Very often in challenging pieces of EU law and in challenging things like, for example, the allergen labelling rules. So the rules that are now in force around labelling products with allergens, the UK wanted a whole different system to that and they fought very hard for it. And ultimately, they lost out, and that's something I'll come to in a moment in terms of where that divergence we may start seeing it happen. But certainly, losing the UK voice is going to be an issue, and is a concern in trade associations, in all of those things. That is potentially going to be a concern. Marketing authorizations, as you will know, all medicines need to have a marketing authorization. Marketing authorizations, where they are held, what entity holds them, all of those issues have come up and have caused very serious concern, particularly for pharma companies in the UK where their marketing authorisations have been UK-based, because suddenly they are outside the EU. And so we have seen a lot of clients moving their marketing authorisations to Ireland. And a lot of them would already have entities here. Some of them are setting up entities, but a lot of them already have very significant manufacturing here, for example. But in fact, the marketing authorisation may have been held by a UK entity, and it may have been issued by the MHRA. So the HPRA, which is our newly named Irish Medicines Agency, has been very busy in facilitating the issuing of marketing authorisations. The whole regulatory infrastructure around drugs, around how is it going to be controlled, good manufacturing practice, good distribution practice, who is going to monitor this, particularly when you use the land bridge to the UK, which is the way which most of our drugs and medical devices both come on and off the island. And indeed, the idea that, you know, there is also bulk products, so there's ingredients both in drugs and in food that there is two-way traffic in. So that regulatory infrastructure in terms of inspections, you see there inspections, product releases. So drugs need to be batch released by a qualified person. At the moment, if you know anybody who's looking to qualify to do something or to study something in college, they should go and become a qualified person, because there is an absolute shortage of them in Ireland at the moment. They are the most in-demand people you can find, because all of the drugs companies that need to have product released in order to put it onto the European market, it needs to be released by a qualified person. And no longer will that qualified person be able to be based outside of the EU, which is in the UK. So again, that batch release, all of that, how is that going to work? And at the moment, you know, we don't know, but these are the issues that are being raised. And the pharmaceutical companies, it's interesting in terms of pharmaceutical companies and the drug and the food companies. The pharmaceutical companies, and certainly our clients, adopted a no regrets policy about 18 months ago. So they took this view, you know what, this may never happen. And it might all be nice and soft and transition and it'll all be great. or it could be horrible. So we are going to take a no regrets policy. We're going to move our marketing authorizations. We're going to employ people. We're going to potentially expand our operations in Ireland. We're going to look at our logistics and our distribution. And if it turns out that we didn't need to do all of that, well, at least we're better prepared and we've done it. The food companies have been much slower. And one of my clients told me yesterday, you know, I think we're going to spend some money on this. I thought, what have you been doing for 2 years? But, you know, they're now beginning to think we really are going to have to put systems in place. So, again, things like clinical trials, orphan designations for drugs, those things need to be held by EU entities. How are you going to do that? How are you going to design your clinical trial, your investigative trials? All of these things the companies are looking at and thinking about, how are we going to do this in the future? So these are all issues that are keeping us busy. On the food side of things, you have the whole area of official controls. So the official controls, particularly when you look at the area of animal food and animal feed, they need to be checked. We have got very strict rules in Europe around sanitary and phytosanitary rules around animals and animal health and the movement of animals. And so the official controls, making sure that if product is moving through Europe, that it is properly controlled, that it originates where it is supposed to originate in the area, in the field of meat and animal products. Does it come from an authorised establishment? Does it carry the health mark? Does it have all of these things? There are people who need to enforce that. So the area of official controls, when again a large chunk of certainly our trading partner is no longer going to be within the EU, is causing concerns. And people are putting together, you know, kind of scenario planning and thinking about how might they do this. Not only companies, but in fact the regulators are also saying, you know, the FSAI here in Ireland saying, how are we going to monitor this? How are we going to, if we're going to have to take all these additional samples and inspections, and who's going to actually analyse that? Do we have the laboratories available? You know, do we have the personnel? And also, again, you know, what do we do once we have all this data? What are we going to do with it? So official controls and how food law is controlled around Europe is a big issue. Things like labelling is going to become and is becoming an issue, because you have a situation where at the moment we have European food labelling, food information to consumers, so it's the same rules, the odd tweak here and there, but more or less the same rules. In a post-Brexit scenario, there is no guarantees that the UK will continue to go along with the food information to consumers legislation. And I mentioned a few moments ago about allergens. Allergens, and you will have seen in the press a couple reports on a couple of tragic cases which have happened over the last, which have certainly been reported over the last number of months. So this whole area of allergen warning and allergen information to consumers is really at the top of the agenda. And so you could potentially see a scenario, in fact the UK have said, we are going to prioritise how we communicate this to consumers. And we are not convinced that the system that we have at the moment is the right system. That's probably because they lobbied very extensively not to have that particular system. But it is an example of where you may see a situation where they will either revert to the old system of allergen labelling, or they will in fact increase their rules and make them much tighter. And so what you have then is a scenario where if you are selling your product in the UK, you are going to have to label it to comply with their labelling rules. Similarly, if they are exporting product into the EU, it will have to comply with EU rules. RASFF there, you may not be familiar with RASFF. RASFF is the Rapid Alert System for Food and Feed. So this is the system that was set up by the European Commission post-BSE, really, in order to communicate food safety challenges and risks throughout the community. It is a European Union system where all of the member states feed into it. It is effectively a portal. If they discover a batch of dodgy mussels from somewhere, it goes on the rapid alert. We have found these batches of mussels which contain this particular contaminant or micro whatever it might be. And this has been sent to France, Germany, Italy and Spain. Please be aware of this and go and find it and take it off the shelves, for example. So all of those risks and emerging risks are put up on the RASFF system. It is what has helped Europe to really emerge from the food safety issues that we had back in the 90s around BSE and dioxins. It's a very effective system. But the UK will no longer be entitled to be there as a member of the EU. Now, hopefully, there will be some way found to accommodate that, and there will be some form of mutual recognition. They have indicated, in terms of the Food Standards Agency, that they want to share this information. Of course they do. They need to protect their consumers in the same way as all of the other regulators in Europe. But how is that going to happen? And how does that work with data and with information that's supplied and all of those other things that you know you don't think of initially, but then when you start drilling down, you think this is a nightmare. And will they have their own system? And how will that? So there are all of these issues that are really causing concerns. Veterinary controls, again, you know, the veterinary controls, particularly in the meat plants, the whole issue of safety and standards. And this is something I just mentioned. Ray and I were talking at the coffee break. You know, one of the big issues, and I'm sure most of you have read about this and understand this, but you know, it really is a real challenge, is this idea that the UK want to do these global free trade agreements. You know, any of you who know anything about global free trade and trade agreements, it always comes down to the cows. It's down to the cows. It's down to meat and milk. And that is what it's all about at the end of the day. All the other fantastic, glamorous, kind of wonderful things around, you know, around IP and all of these things, actually it comes down to quotas. You've got to buy more of our meat, milk. And if you look at one of the main reasons that the transatlantic trade agreement didn't work in terms of the US way before Trump was because we could not get agreement on those issues. They wanted us to buy their hormone beef and we said we're not buying that hormone beef. And there's an issue around the chlorinated chickens. Now, whether or not, you know, we've all been to the States and we've eaten chicken, and whether it's washed in chlorine or not, we're still here. But the point is, it is not allowed under EU law. And, you know, and so that is a real issue. The standards and the quality systems and the system of regulation that we have, particularly in food, but in food and drug, is really precious to the EU. And the idea that the UK could go and do these deals where really the only thing the US are going to want to do is say, well, you've got to take our beef. That's what the Brazilians want to do, and the Argentinians and the New Zealanders want them to buy their lamb. So, you know, that is the issue. And if they go back to this cheap food policy, we then have a scenario where how is that controlled? And how do you make sure that that lamb and beef and whatever it is, if it comes into the UK, and this is not in the next 6 months, but it could be in 5, 6, 10, 15 years, how do you make sure that that does not enter the European food chain? Or that that does not come into Ireland and is then deemed to be product coming from the island of Ireland that is potentially not identifiable from an origin perspective? So from a practical perspective on the ground, these are the things, and how do we legislate for this and allow for it and really kind of deal with it? I'm probably already over my time, Ray, but listen, I'm going to just fly through some of these, which are the British No Deal. The British No Deal notices, which they published a couple of weeks ago, which were saying, OK, there's a British government, you know, what are we going to do around some of these issues that are really relevant? Geographic indications, huge issue. Again, a huge issue in international trade negotiations. And what is a geographic indication? So it is Imokili cheese is a geographic indication. It is protected by European law, as is champagne, as are Cornish pasties, as is Stilton cheese. So all of these things, Greek yogurt, all of these things have been granted a geographic indication under EU law. And the reason for that is that this idea, this European kind of right to the core of European agriculture and food policy, which is to protect local production, to really say this is a unique product that comes from a unique area. It has been made here for centuries and we're going to give it a particular type of protection. It's effectively intellectual property for food. And it has been very successful in protecting the trade of champagne, of Chianti and Bordeaux and all of those products. And so this is a big issue. The UK have said if there's no deal, the UK government will set up its own scheme. They have said that scheme will be WTO compliant, that the GIs protected under the EU regime will be given new UK GI status, but that the UK will not have to recognise the EU GIs. So these are examples of just some of the things that are going to arise. Okay, 1 minute. You see, the thing about this is there is so much. I think that's what I just want to give you a flavour of, insofar as just one of the things here in terms of food labelling. You know, you need to put down on your label where the food originates and where the food business operator actually lives and is established. So for food of EU origin, you're not going to be able to say that for food coming from the UK. For food where importers import food from the UK, their name and address is now going to have to be on the labels. So all of those things are going to create costs and really ultimately the cost in terms of the issues for food companies and for drug companies as a result of Brexit is a really huge issue. There are, as I say, lots of other things that I could talk to you about, but I think just that just maybe gives you a flavour of some of the issues that are happening on the ground. And, they are some of the issues in terms of law reform, in terms of keeping an eye on the development of laws over the next few years. We may have to reform our laws in order to reflect what is happening, or we may have to go to Europe and say, you've got to help us with this, because the UK is changing the way they do business in such a way that it is really having a detrimental effect on us. So thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to take questions afterwards. Thank you.